Welcome back, everybody. It's the Decline and Fall interview special today, and I'm very pleased to welcome to the program today David Miller, who is, some of you might remember, he won a employment tribunal against his former employer, a university in this country, Bristol Uni, which, shall we say, illegally fired him after a witch-hunting campaign orchestrated by Zionist activists. And, of course, his employment tribunal win was very important in terms of defending academic freedom and freedom of speech in this country. And the reason why we got him here today is because, of course, David is a specialist on tracking the influence of the various different Zionist networks that do operate inside Britain. And he's written a very interesting couple of articles recently for Mint Press News regarding the Zionist networks in Scotland, which we'll come to later on. But before we go any further, David, welcome to the Decline and Fall show.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, joining us, as always, is our co-host and comrade in the once and future socialist Yugoslavia, Kit Clarenberg. How are you doing today?
Very well. All the better for seeing David at long last. It's been a while since we last spoke. David is, of course, you know, a fellow terrorist, according to British authorities. He and I had an interesting chat at the end of, I believe it was the end of last year, after you got hauled off a plane, having just attended a certain funeral.
Yes. That was in February.
That was in February. Oh, okay, my how time flies. But excellent to see you again. Looking dapper as ever. So yeah, Alex, why don't you kick us off, my friend?
Well, before we get to David's recent articles on Zionism in Scotland, I did want to get his reaction to the latest. I think the best word I can think of is a catastrophe. That's going on with regard to the new party, or what was supposed to be the new party of the left in this country, which is the still rather strangely titled Your Party, which was apparently founded by Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana together, who were going to be joint leaders of it. There has been rancor since the start, which has recently blown up into a full-scale row, nominally about Sultana trying to proceed with signing up people to membership before some agreement had been reached with Corbyn. But there is much, much more to this story than meets the eye, and it goes right the way back into Corbyn's tenure as Labour Party leader and the fake anti-Semitism scandal that was promoted consciously by networks of Zionists in this country and, of course, elements in the British state itself. So, David, I wanted to ask you, first of all, does any of this surprise you? And what is your analysis as to why it is that a party which seems to have generated a lot of enthusiasm amongst a certain sections of the British left and more widely has been dogged by dispute and scandal before it even got going?
Well, I mean, we're talking about essentially about events of the last couple of months, but not only does one need to look back to that period you're talking about when Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party, but one also needs to explain quite a lot of different things. I mean, it's been an intense period of the last 2 months, and it's you can tell the story in relation to the dispute between what you can characterize as the Corbyn faction and the Sultana faction in your party. But that narrative, which I feel I'd kind of got on top of a couple of weeks ago, has now been completely queered by the emergence of something called Our Party, which has put the cat amongst the pigeons and is itself a very complex set of relations. So I probably need to talk about that a little bit, but let's go back to the explaining the Corbyn faction and the Sultana faction. So essentially, thinking back to when Corbyn was leader of the party, we'll remember that there was the anti-Semitism scam where thousands of party members were accused of being anti-Semitic for criticizing Israel. And crucial to remember is the fact that the scam, or at least the witch hunt against those members, only really took off once Jeremy Corbyn's people had a grip on the bureaucracy of the Labour Party. That is, once Jenny Formby was appointed as General Secretary, and once Corbyn was able to appoint people to all the relevant committees. In the period before Jenny Formby became General Secretary, one person was expelled in the previous year, and in the period afterwards it was 45, and the year afterwards it was 45, and then after that, many more. And of course, all of the most famous cases were cases of people who were expelled on Corbyn's watch when Jenny Formby was in charge. Of course, we're thinking of Chris Williamson, Jackie Walker, and the many other cases of people who are not as famous. I should mention Mark Wadsworth as well, someone who did literally the least of anybody and was expelled on Corbyn's watch. And these people, let's remember, have to this day not been rung up by Jeremy or had any announcement in the press that Jeremy was sorry or that he felt he shouldn't have done it or that this won't happen again. None of that has happened. And that's why there is a question mark, or at least where there was a question mark some weeks ago. I mean, we've moved way beyond question mark now, about his whether he'd learned any lessons. So we said all these things at the time. We said, look, the people who were in charge of the anti-Semitism committee inside the Labour Party when he was in charge, appointed by Jenny Formby and by Corbyn, these were people who were witch hunters, and these were people who were informed by Zionist ideas and engaged in the witch hunt. And these three people were Harry Habel, who'd been in Momentum and been actually reporting people for anti-Semitism before he became part of the anti-Semitism hit squad, a guy called Patrick Smith, who had been in the well-known Zionist Trotskyist faction, the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, and of course Laura Murray, famously the daughter of Andrew Murray. And they worked closely also with a press person in the Labour Party called Georgie Robertson, who of course is the daughter of the famous lawyer Geoffrey Robertson. Now, the four of them were core to expelling large numbers of people from the party for no reason at all, for criticising Israel. And there's never been an accounting for that process. It's never been Jeremy Corbyn or anyone close to Corbyn saying, we got that wrong last time, we shouldn't have expelled so many people, we actually undermined ourselves, we shot ourselves in the foot, we apologised too much for things which we hadn't done wrong, which weren't wrong. And of course, that apology, apologise and move on strategy was overseen and pushed by one of Corbyn's other advisors, his strategic communication advisor, James Schneider. So it's those people who were responsible. Now, some people have said, you know, oh, well, Jeremy just went along with it. He didn't know. He didn't understand. Schneider wrote his stuff. He didn't necessarily approve of it. And that argument has been one which I think some of us were more sympathetic to perhaps 2 or 3 years ago. But now that doesn't really appear to stand up. And we've seen what's happened in relation to Corbyn's ability to deal with the question of anti-Zionism. And he very, you know, publicly made his response after it was the case that Zara Sultana said at Beautiful Days, the festival in Devon, an event where she did a talk, and I was present at it, where she said for the first time, I'm a proud anti-Zionist. And of course, people liked that because it was the first time someone had been so openly anti-Zionist. And then this activist in London saw Jeremy at a meeting. Are you an anti-Zionist? And he froze and he didn't know what to say and he wouldn't answer. And his press advisor, Ollie de Rose, sort of pushed her away and asked her to stop recording and all of that. And so that made it pretty clear that he was not willing to say that he was an anti-Zionist. Now, of course, I believe he is a Zionist. He still believes in the two-state solution, which effectively makes him a Zionist, who believes in the right of a Jewish state to exist in the land. That's Zionism, you know, a Jewish state in the land, Zionist project, even if it's a smaller one, which they want to make bigger. So that's been a problematic thing for the Corbyn faction, and that the dispute that's been between them Yes, it was over that question of politics, but also over the fact that the Corbyn faction wouldn't, or at least Corbyn wouldn't take decisions. And that's what led Zara Sultana to trip the process and announce the party back in August, and then again to trip the process of announcing people could join up as members just the other day. That's shown the conflict between them in very, very stark relief, and that conflict is still ongoing. Just today, Laura Alvarez, Jeremy's wife, has put out a post on X talking about how Zara must now give all the money back to your party, UK. Well, as everybody knows, that whatever the intricacies of the disagreements and the and alleged breaches that there have been, everybody knows that the agreement was that the MOU operations, which is the vehicle of people who are associated with the Sultana faction, Andrew Feinstein, Bethan Winter, Jamie Driscoll, that they had an agreement with your party that the money would go to them, and that your party would have the data, and once they formed a party, whatever it would be called, that would come together. So there's been all sorts of nonsense, and it's been very bad for Jeremy's reputation. There's a lot, I think, of people who are, you know, very, very defensive of Jeremy's reputation, but especially when we said things, oh, a few months ago now, and I and others were denounced for getting it wrong about Jeremy Corbyn. But now a lot of people are coming round to the idea that actually he's not a great leader, and that in the past what he did was he shot himself in the foot and he threw his best supporters under the bus, and there's no indication that he wouldn't do the same again, given that he's still got the same advisors as he had at the time, including, of course, Carrie Murphy, who ran his office when he was leader, and James Schneider, who remains his communications advisor. And in fact, Jeremy tried to put both Schneider and Murphy into the seven-person executive committee, which he proposed should be appointed for your party. And he proposed all seven names for this executive committee. And my understanding is that Zara Sultana said that there wouldn't be any such thing. And so there's not been an executive committee appointed because they can't agree. So that's where we are with that dispute between those two factions. And there's much more that could be said about that. But of course, what's happened since then is this new intervention from something called Our Party. But I mean, maybe I should stop there.
Well, thanks, David. That's a really good outline of like where we've got to here, and where things came from, and why it's important to examine that whole history in the Labour Party of the mass expulsions carried out by not the Labour Party right wingers, but by Corbyn's people, and the insidious role played by groups like the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, who I would say 99% of people in Britain have never heard of, but who are a very small, and I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, David, but rabidly Zionist Trotskyite organization that has operated in the Labour Party for many, many years, and who were all over the Momentum organization. I remember their activists being there, present within it from the very earliest days, and who actively aided the, what can only be described as the self-destruction of the Corbyn movement by any of its strongest actual advocates. The question of like, well, why is it, do we think, and I want to invite Kit to comment on this as well, like that given that Schneider, Murphy and others led the Corbyn leadership off the road and into a ditch over the refusal to counter the anti-Semitism fakes, and the fake scandal was generated by various interested parties there. The disastrous strategy of like trying to accommodate people like Keir Starmer, who is, I think it's fairly obvious, has been an asset of various agencies of the British state for a long time. Why is it that Corbyn still keeps these people around, given that their record is wholly negative in terms of that? So, Kit, I want to ask you to comment on this and then bring back in David. Kit, you're muted, mate.
The one time you actually want to hear from me and I'm muted, but in all seriousness, I must admit that, call it sheer bloody minded naivety. I was actually quite, enthused, when it was announced in an admittedly rather cack handed manner that Sultana and Corbyn were going to be forming a new party. My heart immediately sank when one of, if not the first interview Corbyn gave outlining their new party's terms was to Owen Jones, who, as Alex and I have discussed at some length, was a key wrecker of the Corbyn project, indeed wrote an entire book throwing Corbyn and all of his supporters under the bus, and legitimizing completely baseless claims of the Labour Party being infected with anti-Semites, and also had the temerity to claim that that Israel has a right to exist and it is in no way like previous settler colonial enterprises. He doesn't give an explanation for why, because it's completely untrue that it isn't. But this kind of perked my suspicions that he wasn't just being given bad advice, that maybe that this was always intended to be it was never intended to be anything truly radical, and it was just going to be a continuation of what Labour was like under his leadership, which was, not very good. Yet again, he has picked a certain individual named James Schneider as his is he the head of communications again? James Schneider is a lot has been made of the fact that his wife is an advisor to Keir Starmer, which in itself should set off cacophonous alarm bells. He was Jeremy Corbyn's director of strategic communications, who, as David alluded to, was the quote unquote mastermind of the apologize and move on strategy that led to members getting removed, all manner of media opprobrium led to the suspension and resuspension of Chris Williamson, and a variety of other extremely ill-omened and seemingly badly thought out, or were they, strategies extremely bad strategies and approaches to dealing with various problems. I might add myself that I actually spoke to someone a number of years ago who worked in the PR department of the Labour Party under Schneider, and he said it was great because we just sat around doing nothing all day. We were given nothing to do, zero direction, and we just got paid for being on Facebook and texting, and doing no actual work. Perhaps, David, you could tell us a bit more about Schneider and why he's so shady.
Well, it's difficult to work that out entirely because it's quite complicated. Yes, Schneider grows up as a Zionist. He says that he becomes an anti-Zionist or a non-Zionist, I believe, is the terms he used a couple of years ago. Now, he goes to a private school. His dad is involved. His dad dies when he's quite young, when he's a teenager. His dad's involved in a fraud of several million pounds worth of money going missing. Just before he dies, Schneider comes to university, to Oxford, and amongst the people he meets early on and becomes friends with, shares a flat with, remains friends with, is a guy called Ben Judah, who, of course, until recently, very recently, was the special advisor to David Lammy, the foreign secretary, and had previously been at the Atlantic Council, which, of course, is an Atlanticist warmongering think tank, and of course had been named in 2018 in the Integrity Initiative leaks as one of the network cluster members of the Integrity Initiative, which of course was a project funded by the Foreign Office, for which one should read MI6 which was run by the Institute of Statecraft, and a nominally independent think tank, but which was in actual fact overseen by an honorary colonel in the Specialist Group Military Intelligence, which an organization which nobody really knew existed until these leaks came around. That guy's called Chris Donnelly. People might have heard of him from various of your reports. And of course, this was a project overseen by MI6, and in the way of these things, given this money to military intelligence, MI6 aren't really very keen on trusting military intelligence to get things right. So they put in an MI6 serving MI6 officer into the project as the chief operating officer. Big clue in the title there, a guy called Guy Spindler, and of course it was overseen by the career MI6 officer Andy Price, who later became slightly more famous when it was revealed that he was the handler for Paul Mason, when it was revealed that Paul Mason was an MI6 agent. So this is an MI6 project which was supposed to be there to tackle Russian disinformation, but which ended up spending much of its time criticizing Jeremy Corbyn. So there was James Schneider's university friend implicated in the project, subverting James Schneider's boss. They remain friends, apparently. Apparently it's wrong to think that there's anything wrong with him being friends with someone who is clearly at least an intelligence asset, never mind anything else. And his father, of course, also an intelligence asset, still works for the Balkans. What's it called? The Balkans Independent Investigative Journalism Network.
And the Balkan Investigative Reporting Network, yeah. I might add as well that, yes, not only does Ben Judah crop up in the Integrity Initiative leak, so does David Patrick Karakos. He was tipped as running this some kind of outgrowth of the Integrity Initiative called Open Information Partnership, which was set up to basically create a Central and Eastern European network of NGOs, quote-unquote, independent media outlets and fact-checkers to influence events in, quote-unquote, countries of interest to the British Foreign Office. Again, read MI6. Now, Philip Bevin, who is was a former friend of Jeremy Corbyn and was once within his inner circle, he notes that in a 2020 Spectator article written by Patrick Karakos, Patrick Karakos referred to himself and Ben Judah and James Schneider as in the same terms as protagonists in a John le Carré novel. Which is, you know, seems to be subtly hinting that that they're, you know, not quite who or what they appear on paper. Judah, of course, has now gone on to become a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, which is NATO's in-house think tank and connected to the CIA and funded by arms industry. Defense contractors, numerous ministries of defense and foreign offices across Europe. But hey, I'm sure Schneider is, you know, completely insulated from all of this, you know, and it doesn't have any bearing on his politics or his commitment to Corbyn, fulfilling Corbyn's vision.
And of course, he went on, Schneider, to after the Oxford experience, to co-found Momentum.
Yes.
John Lansman, and of course that was one of the key places where the witch hunt continued to play out. Famously, Lansman wrote that essay saying that we should all stop using the Z word. Zionism is not a useful word to use, and of course Lansman now is a member of the Jewish Labour Movement, which of course is an openly and explicitly Zionist organization. So there's that kind of background to it as well, and Momentum seems to have put out quite a lot of people who have ended up in similar kinds of political positions and roles, and having the same kind of view about the witch hunt, which is that, you know, you shouldn't really say too many nasty things about Israel, or that you shouldn't use the Z word. And many of them are actually in play at present in the contemporary disputes inside your party, and especially this new Our Party thing. So Schneider is an interesting character for all of those reasons. And Patrick Karakos, of course, also was named in the Integrity Moved of Leaks. And there was a fourth friend of theirs at that university called Max Sedib, who is the bureau chief of the FT in Moscow, and who has been involved in articles which have quoted Chris Donnelly at length. So again, there's another connection to, if not quite so directly to British intelligence. So they are all new to the university. I think it was Judah and Seddon who wrote a play in which Schneider acted as the mysterious Dr. Regev. Fantastically apposite name. You don't want to know what happened in that play. Anyhow, so what happens is that Schneider now, of course, you've got all of that history. He's involved in setting up these new organizations, which come about as a result of the Corbyn stepping down from being the Labour leader. So the Peace and Justice Project, which Schneider was the communications advisor for, and he was involved in an organization with, which was set up originally by Justin Schlossberg and Pamela Fitzpatrick. They were the two directors, and Schlossberg stepped down and was replaced last year, I think it was, by Kerry Murphy, who ran Corbyn's office. Now, famously, of course, if you follow these things like I do, Justin, ex-colleague of mine, actually, in 2019, we wrote a book where we both had chapters in it. I hadn't appreciated it at the time, but Justin is a Zionist. And so he was involved in that project. That's another indication of the role of Zionism, although he's removed himself from that project. But Schneider was also involved with We Are Collective. And We Are Collective has brought together a whole range of organizations to try and think about starting a new party. And they've been having this process for a couple of years now, for ages, it seems. And amongst the other organizations that have been involved in this are organizations which are now becoming increasingly important in the debate over this Our Party thing. And in particular, I would note RS21. RS, of course, stands for Revolutionary Socialism. This is the faction which left the SWP over the rape crisis allegations after the allegations had been made and been in circulation for some time. And so they left the SWP, if you like, with a guilty conscience, whereas the other faction who left earlier, before all this started, was an organization now called Counterfire, associated, of course, with John Rees and Liz German, who've run Stop the War for many, many years, and they started it off when they were in the SWP at the time. So that's one organization. Another organization which has been involved is an organization called Assemble. Now, Assemble is perhaps even more obscure than RS21, but Assemble is a part of a whole range of different organizations. And it says it's there to run assemblies, popular assemblies, to make democracy better. Right? That's its kind of tagline. But it's part of a whole range of other organizations under the umbrella of an organization called Umbrella, right? Which is run by Roger Hallam, who is, of course, famously just got out of jail for participating in that Zoom meeting. Now, Hallam, of course, is known for setting up Extinction Rebellion and then a whole series of other organizations, including Youth Demand, Just Stop Oil, Inchoate Britain, and some others. Now, so that what you're seeing there, therefore, is the involvement of that kind of approach to politics. Now, there's been lots of criticism of Extinction Rebellion and its successors, including Just Stop Oil, which we won't have time to go into just now. But that's an incredibly important element of this new move to this new Our Party initiative, in particular because. And this is the kicker, right? In particular, because someone who is associated with Just Stop Oil, and he did joint ventures with Just Stop Oil and the Peace and Justice Project, Corbyn's project, is none other than our friend James Schneider. So what we see with this is that there's a whole series of other networks understood, I think, when they think about the Corbyn faction versus the Sultana faction. People haven't worked out that this new faction that's come in, the Our Party faction, which wants to try and get everyone to get on with each other and to have a new way of doing the party is actually also connected with James Schneider. And that's really something which is a bit of a hammer blow for those of us who think that this Our Party initiative get over the difficulties there have been between Corbyn and Sultana.
So that's a rather revealing set of connections there, David, because what you have essentially is a network of organizations, or many organizations, but a few people who run or have a significant influence over them. And they all seem to be barely two steps removed from some very significant figures in the British intelligence services. And now, of course, we at this at the Decline and Fall don't have direct evidence of what exactly the conversations have been and what exactly the planning is. But at the very least, shouldn't it make people raise questions about the your party, about this other network that's emerging, Our Party, and also about really the role that Corbyn himself is now playing? If he's surrounded by these people who are not only consist of like some very hard line, I would say, supporters of the state of Israel, but also with direct connections to some of the shadiest parts of the British state and Paul Mason, frequent show favorite, by the way, it should make people who are quite honestly getting excited about this ask some questions about, well, what is this really, if it's covered with these people who it is very well established who what they're tied to. So first I'll go first to Kit and then back to you again, David. Kit, your response to do you think that this network symbolizes in terms of its impact on the Corbyn project, and should this lead us to raise questions of the role that Corbyn himself is playing, given that he must know some of the connections of these people?
Well, yes, indeed. And I think that the aforementioned Phil Bevin, and we'll have to get him on the show sometime, Alex, but he actually, the reason that he fell out with Corbyn was because he was trying to warn Corbyn about the connections of Schneider and the very obvious interpretation that Schneider would be, could well be, in fact, inevitably was, trying to undermine him. And that's how they fell out, and they've not really spoken since. And that raises the question of whether Corbyn was very aware that he was surrounded by people who were trying to undermine him and was intensely relaxed about that. There is a wider point to make as well, that Schneider operates within this kind of, call it a sprawling nexus. Again, I think that we don't necessarily have enough time to really delve into this, but it's called Plan C. Plan C has given birth to, Novara Media, all of these supposedly radical media outlets, organizations, activist groups, that when it comes to it, take the establishment line and actually serve as restrictions on revolutionary politics. To use the example of D-Linker in WikiLeaks cable, diplomatic cables, there are records of high-ranking representatives of D-Linker, which is Germany's left party, if viewers are unaware, that where they admit that they stand on a platform of NATO dissolution in order to attract the votes of the significant proportion of German citizens who want out of NATO. And they do so, A, to trap that dissent, but B, to ensure that Germany never leaves NATO, because Berlin is not going to be leading the international charge to dissolve the military alliance, even if it had the power to, which it doesn't. And I think that there is a very real risk that, I made the point that the timing of your party's launch was potentially an unintentional political masterstroke, because, it came just under a year after, Keir Starmer's election, when the sheer horror of Labour was writ very large, and even his staunchest centrist supporters, like the god-awful Ian Dunt, were throwing him under the bus.
And this was a potentially ripe time for creating a new, truly radical force in British politics. Of course, an alternative explanation is it was launched specifically at this time where there's enormous amounts of dissent and a majority of Britons want Starmer to stand down and people are crying out for an alternative, that your party is just a way of, again, trapping dissent. And funneling disillusionment and yearning for change into a vehicle that won't achieve that by design.
David, what's your analysis of the role that Corbyn is actually playing now, given that he is surrounded by these various shady characters that you've been detailing for us?
Well, I think it needs to be explained a little bit more is Kit mentioned this organization called Plan C, which is a very obscure, I know we've been talking about a lot of obscure organizations, but a very obscure organization, but which is a kind of a anarcho-communist, it sort of styles itself autonomous in the Italian sense, an anarchist organization, anti-authoritarian movement. And it sort of works through networks. Now we've already been talking about networks and about the umbrella network with Just Stop Oil and Assemble and all those kinds of elements, Youth Demand, which of course does stuff from Palestine. But Plan C appears to have a whole series of other organizations with which it's connected, sort of in the manner really of Trotskyist groups who create front groups. So Plan C seems to have a whole range of other organizations like the London Renters Union, or there's an organization called Common Knowledge. There's the Autonomous Design Group and a whole series of other organizations which appear to be connected in some way with Plan C. Many of these organizations are based in an office in London called Pelican House, which of course is a new subject of interest for some of us. And if you look at that organization, you find that there's a large number of organizations which have connections to Plan C. And that's not the only things they have connections to, but that's one of the things. And of course, also involved there in sharing that office is the Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung, which of course is the foundation funded by the German state on the basis of how many seats Die Linke get in the Reichstag. And of course, it's been involved in funding Navarra, and indeed, Paul Mason's been associated with it. And so there's those kinds of connections there. And that's a really very interesting set of organizations. And the Plan C's people seem to be involved with Schneider related people, with the Assemble lot, etc. So there seems to be a kind of interpenetration of those two networks, and Schneider appears to be related to both of them. Let me say one more thing about Plan C, which is that they are big up on the whole question, the whole Rojava experiment, the Rojava revolution, which of course, as some people will know, is where elements from the PKK, the Kurdish Communist Party, have been fighting the Syrian government, as was, and the government of Bashar al-Assad, in order to keep the Syrian Arab Army out of northeast Syria, where the CIA was involved in stealing the oil which belongs to the Syrian people. So the PKK are involved there in effectively a CIA operation. Now, the Plan C people are big up on the PKK and the SDF who are fighting that, and then the YPG in Rojava. And indeed, they've sent their comrades over there. In fact, one of them was killed in action, fighting to defend the CIA's interests in northeast Syria. So that's why someone like Phil Bevin refers to them, to Plan C, as an intelligence cutout. Now, whether you would use that terminology or what that terminology means exactly, it's perfectly clear that they've been working with the CIA, and indeed, they've also been involved in some of their comrades from the international comrades have gone to fight in Ukraine. And as we know, what happens there is that they end up under the command of the Azov battalion and taking orders from fascists, literal Nazis. And so that's the kind of curious way in which this political tendency has operated, it appears to be a radical autonomist faction, but it ends up being able somehow in its head and practically to collaborate with imperialist forces on the international stage. And of course, that's one of the reasons why people are very skeptical about their involvement in our party, which of course is one of the people who drafted this Our Party letter, which was sent out last Thursday or Friday. Many of them have connections directly or indirectly with Plan C, and that's very revealing, I think, of where we're at with this. And people who've gone through the agony of having their image of Jeremy Corbyn battered and bruised, and now are beginning to wonder about Zara Sultana. Many of them are jumping on this thing of Our Party and thinking, well, this is how we get over the disputes between Corbyn and Sultana. We have this new thing called Our Party, and they haven't yet understood. The research hasn't properly been publicized yet, hasn't properly been done yet. They haven't yet understood what the forces are which are underlying this new realignment. I should mention also that one of the other organizations in Pelican House is RS21, which I mentioned previously.
Well, it's remarkable just how much the networks that operate here in and around your party and your bit of Jeremy Corbyn trace back to pro-Zionist, pro-imperialist politics in practice, if not in their stated theories. But it's worth mentioning at this stage that, of course, the PKK, Kurdistan Workers' Party, underwent a change over 20 years ago now from being a somewhat Marxist-Leninist organization to being a devotee of what is referred to as municipal confederalism, which is the theories of the American anarchist and Zionist, a certain Murray Bookchin,
yes,
who is distinguished by the fact that he was rabidly hostile to the actual reality of the American working class, and also was, along with, it must be said, many others of that milieu, including many Trotskyites, more than sympathetic to Israel, but saw Israel as some kind of, if not a model of anarchism, then certainly something that he saw as a positive thing in the world. And the conversion of the PKK over to the ideas of Bookchin should have really been an indication as to where it was going, which was into being something that was going to be pressed into the service of Israel, the United States, and Britain in a long-term plan to essentially rip apart the Syrian state. And of course, a large numbers of leftists in Britain cheerily went along with this because no one actually investigated the reality of what the YPG, YPJ actually are and just looked at the branding and saw, oh, this looks good. We'll go with this.
Sure.
But David, I want just to ask you a supplementary question on the sort of naivety and frailty of like the British left. Many people who backed Corbyn in his original guise as Labour Party leader and still back him to this day will routinely describe him as an anti-Israel figure or an anti-Zionist figure. But he's made it pretty clear that he's not. He's a man who advocates the two-state solution, which, as you point out, effectively makes him a Zionist. But I wondered if you could just clarify on this, which is that why do you think it is that so many in the British left adopt this position of nominally being anti the Israeli government or blaming it all on Netanyahu or saying that there needs to be a negotiated settlement, but refuse to realize like the full reactionary and horrific nature of the Zionist state and the movement that supports it? Why are so many on the British left unable to deal with this, do you think?
Well, I think that in the end, that it's not just a question of abstract theoretical weakness. That it's a question, we have put it, I did a piece on this last week on Mint Press News. It's about the infiltration of the British left by Zionism, and in particular by those currents of left Zionism, socialist Zionism, the ones that set up the state of Israel, the people who were in the Haganah and the Palmach, as opposed to in the Stern Gang and the Ergun. And these were people who regarded themselves as socialists, who set up the kibbutzim thinking that this would be a novel social experiment. And many people on the British left went along with that, for that time being. Famously, Tony Benn was on a Hashomer Hatzair kibbutzim, that's the furthest left Zionist faction, on VE Day when the Nazis were defeated in Europe. Chomsky was on one of their kibbutzim. Mm. Barry Sanders was on one of their PhD supervisor, Greg Filo, was on one of their kibbutzim. Tony Quiff, of course, is famously met his wife, Cheney Rosenberg, on a Hashomer Hatzair kibbutzim before he became an anti-Zionist. And he criticizes that tendency in Zionism, of left Zionism, very, very well in 1946. And if only the SWP today were true to that legacy, then they would have much better analysis. And what that's meant is that there's been a sort of softness on Zionism, and also in the anti-racist movement back 40 or 50 years, a tendency to think that in order to defeat the far right, we have to have a broad front. And the far right was conceived of as being fascism. The anti-racist movement had to target fascism. And that's why we had in the 70s, remember, the anti-Nazi League and, of course, Rock Against Racism. And that was an alliance between people who came from a Trotskyist background, who were anti-Zionists, including Jewish anti-Zionists, and those who were left Zionists. So, I mean, recently I was in the anti-Nazi League's archives in Warwick University, and you can see the people who wrote the letters there. There were two factions. There were anti-Zionists and there were Zionists, but they were working together. And that's because they had they conceived that racism had best to be fought by targeting a united front against fascism, right? Rather than taking the position that if you wanted to defeat racism, you had to target its main forms in the society. Now, in the 70s, and certainly now, the main forms of racism in the society are from the state. They're from the police and from the intelligence service. They're from institutionalized racism. And there's only been, as far as I'm aware, one national organization in this country which saw that as being the main target of an anti-racist movement. And that was led, of course, by Mark Wadsworth, the Anti-Racist Alliance. All the other organizations were effectively an alliance with left Zionist currents, and that's why they couldn't that's why they had problems in the way in which they analyzed the far right and racism, because there was a limit on what the Zionists would put up with. And the limit, of course, was that you couldn't discuss Palestinian liberation and you couldn't discuss Zionism as a form of racism in itself. And that, of course, is the historicness of the British left and Zionism, and I think that has affected us all the way up to today.
Well, yes, so I wanted just to come back on that, because we've recently seen a large-scale demonstration in London led by a man who calls himself Tommy Robinson. He's in actual fact, his name is Stephen Yaxley Lennon, a man who is a rabid devotee of Israel and Zionism, who is nominally leading this supposedly mass anti-migrant movement. But in reality, most of his work seems to be doing essentially foot soldier work and organizing against anti-Zionism advocating for Zionism amongst those who are drawn to like anti-migrant activism. And this, it seems to be like one of his like primary areas of activity. And along with many in the organizers of this new wave of anti-migrant protest, a lot of them seem to be aligned with the state of Israel and aligned with Zionism. Now, to pick up on something you just said, David, this also their opponents on the left, funnily enough, also are predisposed towards Zionism. Because the organization that actually nominally leads the anti-racist movement in Britain, Stand Up to Racism, has a direct connection with Zionism, does it not? In that they include Zionists in their organizing. So you have a strange situation where you have the man named Tel Aviv Tommy on the one hand, the standard to racism on the other, both of whom are influenced by an ideology which even like fairly people who are fairly liberal-minded have to admit these days is a rabid, racist, and deeply dangerous ideology, and yet we have both left and right in Britain embedded in it. What's your analysis of this situation, David?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you mentioned stand-up to racism. I mean, yeah, of course, they historically take on the tradition of the Anti-Nazi League, Rock Against Racism, Unite Against Fascism, all the same kind of ideological current. And then, of course, you've also got a parallel openly Zionist anti-racist movement, so organizations like the Community Security Trust or Hope Not Hate, for example, which is a Zionist organization. People may not be aware of that. So that's absolutely part of what the problem is, that there's not been a real coming to terms with Zionism. I mean, but that's not just the case with the far right. I mean, what happened with the far right, as is probably reasonably well known, is that in 2009 and 2010, Zionist think tank people from the States came over to the UK and to the rest of Europe, and they approached all of the people on the far right and said, look, we want you to change your politics. We want you to give up on Jew hatred, and we want you instead to concentrate just on hating the Muslims. And if you do that, we'll give you money. And that's what led to the formation of the English Defence League and to the Counter-Jihad Europa network across most European, West and some Eastern European countries. So that's absolutely what happened. So they co-opted the far right, and they already had a base in the left. But they've also, let's remember, co-opted all of the rest of the mainstream parties. I mean, the Reform on the far right, the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, the Greens, which still remains pro-NATO, and indeed the Lib Dems. Only your party and the Workers' Party. Workers' Party is anti-Zionist, but your party is having a big debate about whether it's anti-Zionist or not. Zahra Sultana has said that she's anti-Zionist. She hasn't put a lot of meat on those bones, but there's clearly a massive debate internally. And then the membership, in my understanding, impression, is very anti-Zionist. Increasingly, it's very difficult to be openly a Zionist on the left. But nevertheless, the people who are in charge of trying to run the party, they are much less keen on an anti-Zionist position. And that's the battle we have ahead, it seems to me, to express the red line on Zionism in the creation of the party, as opposed to some of the other issues which other people have been suggesting.
So I might add as well that I think that, you know, Zahra Sultana has come out swinging in terms of overtly defining herself as anti-Zionist and pushing for the party to be anti-Zionist. It mustn't be forgotten that she was cheering the fall of Assad, and then I think maybe 24 hours later was complaining that Israel was carpet bombing the country, this was a completely inevitable upshot of the fall of Assad, which she supported. So, I mean, you know, I do think that there are potentially questions to be asked about how sincere her position is. She could well just be reflecting the, extremely hardline anti-Zionist fervor of their members. I'm not saying that's absolutely the case, but it's certainly, you know, questions need to be asked about that.
Well, yes, certainly. And the position of the wider British left on the question of Syria was also terrible. It must be said. We've commented, you and I, Kit, on this before. It was terrible a decade ago. It remained terrible. They suddenly acted surprised when Gilani came to power and essentially allowed Israel to absorb a significant section of the south of the country and then cut on all of the military facilities. Whilst Gilani says, "Can I please recognize you some more, sir?" Another point that everyone must bear in mind, and that is largely forgotten now, is that Gilani was in ISIS. ISIS, of course, infamously, for all the dramatic pronouncements, only fired once at Israel and apologized.
Yes.
And ISIS fighters were, and again, this was commented on in the Israeli media, they were treated in Israeli military medical facilities. And this was, again, acknowledged openly everywhere, but of course amongst the various people on the British left who were all loudly in favor of the fall of Assad, but then acted surprised when the main beneficiaries of this were Israel and the United States and Britain, who were the countries, along with Turkey, the Erdogan regime, who are now running this HTS government in Damascus, because apparently nobody bothers to do any research on these things. David, did you want to add anything to that?
No, that's right. I saw that the outgoing head of MI6 just said, was it yesterday or the day before, that we did establish contact with HTS maybe 1 or 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But of course, but as we know, they've been running many of the operations for them from 2012 onwards. I mean, it was MI6 who led on that operation. The CIA had to come in covertly because of the prohibitions by the Obama presidency, and of course MI6 created the White House in order to as the contract from the Foreign Office states, if you look at it, in order to improve the image of HMG on the international stage, and that's of course what led to the chemical attacks, the so-called chemical attacks, which were staged with the help of MI6 and the White Helmets, including deliberate killing of civilians to be arranged before the cameras in order to create the red line, crossing the red line, which would lead to bombing of Syria by the West. And of course, that was successful in some respects. So yeah, this is a joke, and it's not just the left that, of course, have bought into that, but some aspects of the anti-war movement amongst Muslims also did the same thing. And it's a symbol of the weakness of the analysis of imperialism and the way in which the secret state operates, both on the left and in some aspects of the Muslim community, which I think is profoundly worrying.
Indeed. And I think, just to add on that point, I mean, immediately after the fall of Assad, I wrote a number of articles about covert, indirect US and British assistance for HTS, with, again, Britain taking the lead. And there's a remarkable passage in a leaked document related to an alleged anti-HTS operation run by MI6, which stated that HTS is unlikely to attack British-funded organisations such as the White Helmets on the ground. You fast forward to today, and Hamish de Breton Gordon, this MI6 agent who was centrally involved in many of the staged chemical attacks, he told the National outlet, the White Helmet should become Syria's official fire and emergency service. There are indications that the Free Syria Police, which were again created by MI6 for propaganda purposes and ran Sharia courts on behalf of al-Nusra and ISIS in occupied territory, they are now Syria's national police force. This is all absent from this was entirely absent from the chorus of have we lost David?
Yeah, David's had to go because his time's run out, Kit. But if you want to finish your point, then we'll wrap up there.
Yep. Okay, yeah, sure. Well, I mean, this was entirely absent from any consideration of the on both the mainstream and less mainstream strands of the British left, was that it's the British stoking up all of this violence which the Syrian state is responding to. It is a foreign fermented crisis. I do notice now that the Free Syria crowd are eerily silent as the progeny of ISIS and al-Qaeda, who now run Syria, are doing everything that people like us are warning they would do if they took power for a decade. It's
it brings me no joy to have been proven correct yet again on this point, but there we are.
Well, yes, and I think that's a good point to end this on. I'll just conclude the video by saying, of course, thank you to David, who's had to run off to get for another commitment, for coming on today. He's a man with a great deal of understanding of these issues, and we'll certainly be having him back on to discuss such things again. I'll just conclude this video by saying that if you're somebody who's watching this, who got infused by the emergence of your party and the prospect of Corbyn and Sultana leading us, look, no one's blaming you for that. Look, we've all gone down the road of political experiments that are disastrous. I've certainly been involved in some, and I've talked about those at length. But ask the question, like, how long are you going to give Corbyn another chance for? If he surrounded himself with intelligence assets, essentially, the first time around, and he not only doesn't learn from it, but he brings back all the same people again this time around and insists that they be given a controlling influence over the new organization, then really, no matter what your opinion of like the politics of Corbyn or the politics that Corbyn says he's in favor of, you have to ask a question about what role this man is playing. And you have to ask a question about, like, why is it that so many of the networks that control what is known as the left in Britain are aligned with or controlled by British intelligence agencies or British intelligence assets? Because this game is something that the British ruling class have played for a very long time, and they're very good at it, which is hiding in plain sight, basically, and relying on people not doing their research. But we at the Decline and Fall Show are determined to bring you said information, and we will be back with you again with a regular episode later in this week. Until then, thank you to David Miller for coming on, and I'll leave the final word to Kit over in the once and future Socialist Yugoslavia.
Well, yeah, I mean, as ever, thanks so much for joining us, folks. We hope that you found this instructive and entertaining, even in the most kind of gallows humor manner. Like, share, subscribe, tell your friends, and yeah, see you very soon. God bless you. Take care.